Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast, where we interview our industry's top female executives from Australia, New Zealand, and around the world. I'm Michelle Batsis, your host and the Chief Executive Officer of the Public Transport Association, Australia, New Zealand. We're raising the voices of women for everyone who works in public transport and mobility, and particularly for any of our listeners who are early in their transport careers and looking for inspiration. Each of our guests shares her views on the future of public transport and provides insights into their career journeys. Make sure you follow Women Who Move Nations on your favorite podcast platform and rate the show to help more people find us. You can also join our community on LinkedIn by searching Public Transport Association Australia New Zealand. We're also on Twitter at PTAANZ_, or visit us at www.ptaanz.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. This week on Women Who Move Nations, I'm joined by Elizabeth Mildwater, the Deputy Secretary of the Greater Sydney Division at Transport for New South Wales. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
So, Elizabeth, today I wanted to talk about your career, your achievements, and particularly what you've learnt during that process, and of course, what's happening in transport in New South Wales. And I know that you're based in Sydney and look after the Greater Sydney area. So to start, can you tell us about your current role and focus areas, but also how did you end up at Transport for New South Wales?
My current role is Deputy Secretary of Greater Sydney at Transport for New South Wales. So my division is responsible for the provision of all transport modes within Greater Sydney, as well as planning out to approximately a sort of 5 to 10 year horizon and all the stakeholder relationships, responsible for all the customers and all the communities within Greater Sydney. It's actually the third Deputy Secretary role I've had within transport in a period of 3.5 years. I originally joined back in early 2017, being responsible for people and corporate services. And I was recruited into that role, having lived in Melbourne for about 16 years before that and overseas for maybe 7 or so years before that. I guess I did a lot of different things. But I most recently, prior to transport, I was working for Save the Children in Melbourne, heading up their Australian programs. So heading up all the programming with Aboriginal families, with immigrant families, that sort of thing throughout Australia. I was approached to apply for a job at transport. And I had been, it wasn't as crazy as it might sound, I had been in infrastructure for most of my career prior to that. And so when I was approached to apply for a job in transport, I was pretty excited about it, and particularly excited when Tim Ridden, who was then Secretary, explained to me his vision for changing the New South Wales public service and the provision of transport along with that to better represent the communities and the customers that we work with, so to make it a more diverse place to work. He sold me a very big vision that was pretty compelling, and I haven't regretted it for a single day.
You've had a really incredible experience there, Elizabeth, in terms of both how you've come into transport and then to have that view of the different areas of the department and the organisation and the impact that it has for customers and communities. And I'm excited to talk a bit later in the podcast, actually, about your career. But if we talk about transport for the moment, I think it's a really interesting portfolio that you have in that Sydney is the biggest city in Australia. It's certainly a big tourist destination as well, which we've seen significantly impacted this year. And what I'd like to talk about is what's going on right now with COVID-19. And perhaps you could offer us some insights into what authorities are thinking about in terms of what the future of public transport looks like now and what changes might need to be made to adapt to new mobility behaviour.
It's a fascinating topic, Michelle. And one of the things I suppose that I love about being in public transport is how everyone across not only Australia, but across the world is really sharing learning and experience. I think I've found it a really generous sector since moving into it a few years ago, but at the moment it seems to be, you know, one of our absolute strengths. UITP, for example, organising things like this where we can share learning. It is an absolutely fascinating time, but I feel like we're all learning together, and we're just continuously sort of testing what's working in different places and trying new things. I think the stage we're at is quite pivotal at the moment. Until, you know, recently, and for some cities, they still are still very much in a reactive phase. And I feel like in Sydney, we're starting to come out of that, although we're still, you know, opening up. So we're opening up new capacity on our public transport from the 1st of July by allowing people to sit one seat apart rather than we had our green dots spread further apart. We're putting them closer together but still making people leave a seat free between them. It means it'll take our capacity up to just under 50%. But while we're doing that, we're still really conscious that, you know, things could change every day with the health system and we have to respond to that if it happens. But the bigger discussion now, I think, is what you alluded to in terms of where are cities really going and what's the impact of COVID on the future of our cities. And I know around the world, really big cities like Sydney are pondering this. The answer for each of us probably depends on a whole lot of things, you know, history, geography, what our economic strengths are. But we're all sort of asking some of the same questions. And given that transport is a real enabler of cities and economies, to some extent, our future is dependent on what the answers to those questions are in time. So in Sydney, you know, some of the questions are, will we ever actually move back to everyone travelling to the CBD, regardless of our current constraints, which mean that we can't bring everyone back into the CBD. But thinking beyond that, when we are able to, is it actually the right thing for people to be travelling into the CBD every day? Or now that people have learned what it's like to work from home or work in other places, would it be better to let them keep doing that? And there are economic pros and cons for staying in local communities versus coming into the CBD. But there are also much bigger questions then being asked about, well, what does it tell us about the future of various types of manufacturing? Do cities need to, I've heard the term reshore come into use recently about cities thinking about whether they should be bringing back onshore, perhaps some manufacturing or services that were previously done offshore. I mean, these are very early stages of thinking, but I think lots of cities are thinking the same. And depending on what the answers to those questions are, that then has huge implications for public transport. If new industries come back to Sydney, you know, most likely in the outer reaches of Sydney, or if people don't travel into the CBD as much, you know, there are also people are looking at population projections and seeing whether COVID has sort of changed the projections that were already underpinning our city's growth. So lots of these really interesting questions need to be answered over probably the coming, I would say, 6 to 12 months, and then we'll have to pivot off that in transport. At the same time, though, I guess we're already looking at, you know, an assumption that not everyone will come back to travelling the way they once did. So at the very least, that gives us the opportunity to start reprofiling demand and not needing to build in response to such big peaks with any luck. While these things won't happen overnight, I think we can see that some of these trends are now more likely. So if we can give them a bit of a nudge, we might be able to push them in the direction. So these are big questions, and it's actually a really exciting time to be part of both the discussions of those questions and also how public transport can respond.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, it's early days. So I think it's safe to say that there's an assumption that we might not see all of the workforce go back to the central business districts. But interesting questions around managing demand and shifting the peak. And I think certainly as well, something you referred to earlier when you were talking about your role was that you're managing a large number of stakeholders and certainly your private operator partners as well. And you've referenced that you're adding capacity to the system and obviously looking at the types of services you're providing and what you might need to provide or perhaps not provide in the future. So what kind of thinking have you been doing in transport around that changing landscape and the potential partnerships that you might have with operators going forward?
We were already, I think, on a journey as transport to sort of broadening out to look at our operators and the broader transport ecosystem more as a whole system rather than just focusing on insourced and outsourced service providers. We've been sort of starting to describe ourselves as integrators. And so I think what's happened during COVID is it's actually taken that idea to another whole level because we really have worked closely with our operator partners over the recent months on a daily basis. Every decision we had to make about distancing about safety of drivers on various modes, about sanitizers, about cleaning, all of that. Customers didn't distinguish and continue not to distinguish between whether the services are run by us ourselves or by some of our private operators. So we've actually had to run the whole system as one. And our private operators have worked so well with us. It's been a terrific, really leap forward, I think, in us learning to be more of an integrator. That's only going to happen increasingly over the coming years. We're already in the early stages of franchising the remaining regions of our STA, our government-run bus services. And after that, all of our Greater Sydney bus services will be privately run. So we actually have to think of ourselves in quite a different way. And I think we are just learning that. Our private operators are teaching us things about how to do that. And I think also they're bringing us expertise in the immediate situation. They're bringing us expertise and learning from other parts of the world where they've also had to respond to COVID. We're able to leverage off their expertise as well.
Yeah, which is really great. And certainly we've seen that actually. I mean, it's been great to have that learning from what's happening overseas, because many countries, as we know, were 6 to 8 weeks ahead of where we were in Australia and have come out of the recovery sooner, although obviously that's different depending on countries and areas around the world. I think what's been really interesting too is that what we've seen with COVID-19 is that it's provided a really unique opportunity for many cities, and including for Transport for New South Wales and Sydney, to think about changing the way people think about their travel. And whether that's to and from work or just around their neighbourhoods or other types of journey trips they might do. I mean, one of the key things that we've been seeing is around active transport, cycling and walking, which has seen a renaissance in many cities around the world. But also the question around that some people might be more inclined to use their private vehicles instead of public transport at the moment. And we're seeing that anecdotally in cities around the world, and we're seeing the evidence come out as well. The Australian Bureau of Statistics has released its data from May, which indicates about 65% of people don't feel comfortable using public transport to get to work. And I think that's an interesting insight into what then might determine travel behaviour going forward. So I wanted to ask you, what is Transport for New South Wales doing to ensure public confidence in the transport system? You know, with that view to discourage that longer term modal shift that might happen with a single driver vehicle.
Yeah, it's one of the aspects of COVID that presented both the biggest challenge and biggest opportunity, I think. On the one hand, we've seen just a complete outbreak of people walking and cycling, but on the other hand, people are more comfortable driving, and one we'd obviously like to encourage and one discourage. So, yeah, a lot of it is, as you said, Michelle, about confidence. So from the very outset of COVID, I guess what we've tried to really focus on, and both the doing but also making public that we're doing, are things such as cleaning, sanitising, social distancing on transport. We've focused really hard on that. So we've done something like 400,000 extra hours of cleaning on our services since the start of March. That's over and above the normal cleaning. We have cleaners riding on trains so that people can see them. And of course, they are really cleaning, but they're cleaning very visibly. We have stations set up around the city where buses can get cleaned during the day. The same for point to point, so for taxis and ride shares. We have hand sanitizers, green dots everywhere, obviously, lots of marshals to help people, queue in an orderly fashion or understand what they should and shouldn't do. So we've put quite an effort into trying to focus on that confidence. We want people to feel safe getting on public transport and, you know, not to not want to use public transport for that reason. Also, we went quite conservatively into the distancing on transport when we started implementing the green dots a month or so ago. And so we had them quite widely spaced. And part of that was to be very conservative and give people confidence. And now in our next step, as from early July, we will be putting them closer together. People will still leave a seat free, but that we'll be able to fit more people on our trains and buses and other modes. But it is all about trying to build confidence. But you did say, Michelle, we see it in the sentiment testing. People still do have a concern about travelling on public transport. So we've got to just keep working on it and keep up the high levels of cleaning, be very visible about it. We're doing a lot of briefings with employer groups, workshops, that sort of thing, so they can understand what we're doing. and hopefully get the word out so that they do feel safe. We have seen some cohorts of people keep travelling regardless, so that's great. And, you know, tradies, for example, we now have a new peak in the morning where the, because it's mostly tradies on the train at the early stages, like 6 o'clock, they're quite full. School kids are back on and travelling. But we know we do have a job ahead to encourage other travellers back. We don't want to encourage too many people to get in their cars, but we've had to be sort of pragmatic about it in the short term and just accept that some of it is going to happen, and even, you know, providing pop-up parking to help cater for that need. But you're right, in the long term, it's not a trend we'd like to see continue.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But of course, as you say, you need to be pragmatic. And I think, you know, from my position, having a look at what different cities are doing, I certainly think that what New South Wales and Sydney has done in terms of prevention measures and also building that confidence is really best practice. You know, I think one of the things we've seen is that transport authorities, in terms of their key priorities right now, is actually about delivering excellent health outcomes that focus on public health and safety. And I think that's something we'll now see as part of the remit for authorities going forward. So if we just take a step back and talk more broadly about what's happening in transport and the big innovation trends, and certainly I know that New South Wales has a big innovation agenda, I'm keen to hear from you, you know, what are you seeing perhaps in other cities around the world that you're keeping your eye on in terms of trends and innovations?
Oh, there's plenty in the technology space that we're following. Even during COVID, we've really doubled down on some of our customer apps so that people can now see real-time loading information, taking into account distancing on various modes of transport. So there's plenty going there. I suppose the one thing that I'm really watching at the moment, though, is active transport, walking and cycling. I sat in on a presentation from the Paris Deputy Mayor last Thursday, and it was completely inspirational, I'd have to say, for lots of us around the world who admittedly we're not as advanced with walking and cycling as some cities. To hear directly from people in Paris, both, you know, how well they're doing, but also the challenges they've faced over the years, it was really helpful for us to see that, you know, there are similar things that we all face all over the world, and you can achieve great things when you just keep pushing through. And so for me, that is actually the space that's been most helpful recently, because we can see some of the European cities in particular have been able to roll out pop-up cycleways and extra pedestrian paths quite quickly. And we're now starting to do that. But they also did that off the back of years of, you know, quite a deeply built culture of active transport. And I think we're earlier in the journey, so there's a lot we can learn from them.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess this time presents an opportunity as well to accelerate those types of initiatives and behaviour changes. You know, what I'm really excited to see is how the active transport agenda is going to become a bigger piece really in the mix of choices for travel behaviour. So Elizabeth, I wanted to circle back now really to the purpose of this podcast and also the conversation around diversity and inclusion. And I know you're particularly passionate about diversity. And actually, you hosted one of our Women in Mobility dinners last year, where we bring together senior females to have a conversation about what's going on and that opportunity to connect and also to see each other and build those networks. And for this podcast, you know, I really believe in highlighting the amazing contribution that women are making to our sector and to create a dialogue around the challenges, but also the opportunities when it comes to achieving gender balance in public transport and the broader transport industry. And I would love to hear from you about what Transport for New South Wales is doing in the diversity space. You know, I know there are a lot of initiatives that you have around gender equality and also the opportunities going forward.
Yeah, so you're right, Michelle. Diversity in various forms is really top priority, not only for transport, but for the whole of the New South Wales public service. We have a target of having 50% of our senior leadership positions across the public sector being held by women by 2025. Within transport, the target there is 40%, and we're currently sitting at 31.6. So that in senior leadership, we count several, you know, the top probably 4 to 5 layers. So although it sounds like we've got a fair way to go, I think we have actually made big changes over the last few years. And I guess just as an example, the top level, like the DEPSEC level that I sit at, so reporting into the secretary, we have, I think it's just 67% of us are women. And in the next layer down, it's 55%. And there's still, because we're still going through org change, you know, there's still recruiting happening there. But we've done really well at those top two layers. And I think that's setting us off on a really good trajectory. Part of the way we've done that is just being very, very serious about it. And we've been doing a lot of recruitment at the top levels. And one of the things we have in place is that you have to have a 50-50 shortlist. And if you don't, it needs to go to the secretary, Rod Staple, for approval, having gone through relevant people, you know, below that. So anything in Greater Sydney would have to come to me for approval and then go to Rod. And we don't actually approve very many shortlists that aren't 50. And even I've had some really good experience where something might have come to me with a not a 50-50 shortlist and I've refused it, and they go back and recruit in a different way and come back with, you know, just some knockout female candidates. So I think we've proved that you can do it for just about any position. And I'm pretty confident that as we keep recruiting and implementing our new organisational change, we're going to achieve those targets quite easily. We've also started, I guess, at the other end with the entry-level talent. At the moment, our current cadet year is just under 50% women. But by way of example, in a specific, our trainee train drivers are exactly 50% women, 50% men. So that is really terrific. I don't think you would have just expected that a few years ago if you'd looked at a train driver cohort and thought you could get 50% women. So I think it becomes also sort of self-fulfilling, because women are now seeing that women can do any job in transport and that you can rise to the most senior levels. So I think we've provided now a really big pool of visible role models, and that's starting to pull in other great women as well. So I feel like we're on a bit of a roll. There's still plenty of work to do, but it is really starting to gain some momentum. But of course, it's also underpinned by really gritty monthly reporting and analysis. You know, the rules I talked about with recruitment, all of that sort of thing. There's a lot of data and a lot of reporting that goes into this. But as well, I think the cultural change has really kicked in now, because we've been going at it for a few years and we've made such great strides at the top levels.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, thinking about the numbers that you're talking about and what that split looks like of male and female composition in your workforce, both in the front line but also in the leadership roles, you know, they're numbers that actually we would rarely see in many cities around the world, and I know many authorities would be envious of. And I think what's really exciting is that you're leading the way, particularly around the cultural change that has happened. You know, it's not just about reporting and metrics. And I think what's really interesting is that what I see happening in New South Wales is that you have a focus on diversity internally in your organization, but you're also looking at diversity in terms of the public transport commuters and the community of Sydney and New South Wales and their diverse needs as well. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about what is Transport for New South Wales doing in terms of looking at women's safety on the network, and particularly after dark, which has been a running theme that we've seen in Australia in recent years in terms of women's safety. So what initiatives are you exploring in that space?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I do also wonder whether it will become even more into focus if we change people's hours of work and travel patterns. I think we've really focused on women's safety the last year or two in terms of the nighttime economy in particular. So within New South Wales, I think some of the stuff we've, you know, done is rolled out lots of cameras, safe places on platforms, safe places in trains, that sort of thing, better lighting at stations. But we just relatively recently started turning into something more organised, if I could say that, with the business and other communities in March. And it was just as COVID was sitting in, we launched alongside the Committee for Sydney and the Greater Sydney Commission a women's safety charter, and a whole lot of organisations, both public and private sector, signed up to a charter whereby we all agreed we would start looking at really tangible actions to make Greater Sydney a safer place for women at night in particular. Transport's part of that immediately was in relation to technology. So we launched, on the same day as the charter was launched, we launched an innovation challenge where pretty well anyone could come along and take part in an innovation challenge if they thought they had an idea that would help us increase the safety for women in the city. We launched that sort of early March. We had about 44 formal applications, so people who had really tangible ideas and wanted to pitch it in. They've been through a couple of months of sort of coaching and workshopping, and we've now down to 8 teams who have ideas, you know, very, usually technology-based, about how we might introduce something into the city to help women feel safer. And it is, because we're running it, it is transport focused, but some of them do go beyond just transport. The next step for them all is we have a pitch event later this month where I'm one of the judges, so I'm looking forward to that with a really great panel, and they will pitch us their ideas. We will give them feedback. We won't actually select a winner on the day. It's a bit Shark Tank-like. We give them lots of feedback, and then they go and work with their coaches, and there is a formal evaluation panel to pick a winner. But it is also one of those things, I'm sure we'll get other great ideas out of that process, not just whoever happens to be the single winner. And we have some funding to support implementation of whatever the idea is. But people have come up with varied ideas, as you can imagine, sort of apps that they might have seen used elsewhere in the world or not, developing them for use in Sydney. Some of them are more sort of actual hands-on solutions, but it's a really wide-ranging sort of thing. But I guess the real exciting thing for me was just seeing how many organisations are really focused on this. As you would expect, there were lots of people from various restaurants and nightclub type industry. But I do think if we start asking people to change their travel patterns, so potentially not starting work if you're travelling into an office, not coming in until the middle of the day, you are by definition going to want to travel home later, I would expect. And that may change the profile and volume of travellers we have going home after dark. I think it does. We've only just started to focus on this area, but I do think it might give us another whole impetus to look at our nighttime services and what additional safety measures we might need to provide around that.
Yeah, that's so great. I'm looking forward to hearing about some of the initiatives that come out of that. And I think what's really great with that approach about inviting industry and community to have their say, that it really contributes to those diverse perspectives. On the topic of diversity, let's talk about reconciliation. And I know you're particularly passionate about this topic and that you've helped create Transport for New South Wales Reconciliation Action Plan, and you're now supporting its implementation. For our international listeners, reconciliation is about equality for Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and is a very important topic for us in the transport industry. So Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you, how do you encourage your team to think about influencing and driving employment outcomes for Indigenous people and what you're doing in that space?
I think it's a lot like working with gender diversity as well, but just putting a slightly different lens on it. I really think we need to get to the stage of almost, if not, why not? You know, why haven't you got Aboriginal people in the recruitment pool for any particular role? That would be my dream, that soon that's where we're up to. We're a fair way off that, but I guess, so what we've had to do in more recent times, we've got very specific initiatives to help people recruit pools of Aboriginal people. We've had an entry-level program for a while and a graduate program, and they're really successful in targeting Aboriginal people, Aboriginal students, and getting them into transport. I think we're getting it better at giving managers support to take in students on those programs. And that's not just Aboriginal students, but any student, you know, when it's their first job, they need a bit of extra help. And a manager probably needs a bit of extra help in knowing how to give them the best support. So we're getting better at that. We're doing much more targeted procurement as well. So although there's a couple of areas we're focusing on, both employment but also procurement, and so also getting to work with Aboriginal organisations who can supply various goods and services and making sure they're getting the appropriate preference and knowing how to deal with what can be quite daunting government procurement processes. On some of our contracts or our construction contracts and our new projects like Metro have been absolutely sensational at running sessions to hook up, sort of a dating service, to hook up Aboriginal businesses with non-Aboriginal businesses. We set, you know, it starts from the point that we set quite significant targets on our projects for our contractors to both employ Aboriginal people and use Aboriginal suppliers. And then we help them get there by running workshops and forums where they can all meet each other and see how they can hook up. So there's lots of things we've been doing to try and drive increased employment, both within transport, but within the sector more generally. And I think this is one where we've probably been better at focusing on our industry partners in the construction sector than in our operations. So we're really just starting to turn our minds into how we work with our operations partners as well. So in the forthcoming franchising process, we are being very deliberate about setting targets for Aboriginal employment and services. We're making them realistic given the nature of the services that are being provided, but we're being pretty clear with potential bidders that we expect people to implement our RAP, whether they're transport itself or our partners. I think there's a great willingness out there. A lot of it is about giving people support and guidance as to how to do it.
Yeah, it's great to see Transport for New South Wales be so proactive on these issues and your leadership in this space as well. And I'd like to pivot now, really, and talk about your leadership and your leadership style and your career. And I know you're leading a large workforce. I mean, off the top of your head, Elizabeth, how many people are you actually overseeing in your division?
Yeah, so I think within Greater Sydney, there's sort of 16,500 people, if you count, all the employees we have in trains, buses, light rail. But then, of course, there are the outsource providers as well. But in terms of employees, there's somewhere around 16,000, I think.
Yeah, which is just an incredible number, right? So with 16,500 people, I'm interested to hear from you around how do you lead that workforce? And what's your leadership style and how do you motivate that team given how large and disparate they are? I'm assuming as well, you know, they're working in different locations and on different modes.
Yeah, I always find questions like this really hard, Michelle. I suppose you have to be yourself no matter what role you're doing. So that's, I guess, the starting point for me. I have probably always gone about leadership in a similar fashion. You just sort of have to amplify it as the workforce gets bigger and bigger. It helps that I draw my inspiration from frontline staff. I absolutely love getting about and hearing what they do, meeting them, seeing their world every day. And not just what we would call frontline, but there's lots of layers of people who are effectively frontline in a workforce of our size. So I just really love getting out and listening to people and seeing people in their own environments. And I think people usually respond to that pretty well as well. It's not something you can fake. You either do, you know, you do enjoy it or you don't. And I absolutely love it. So people are enormously proud of what they do. And if you take the time to try and understand it and to listen to them, they'll repay you in spades. I guess what I've found, particularly in the world of public transport, is the vast, vast majority of our people are so motivated. We've seen it really amplified during the COVID crisis. We have record low levels of sick leave, you know, record high levels of employee attendance all round. People are just really motivated when it comes to serving the public. So it's really about leading them in a way that they understand what that means. And in places like Transport for New South Wales at the moment, where we're really trying to reshape, we say redefine what transport looks like in Greater Sydney so that it's much more joined up. It's not so modally based. We're offering people end-to-end journeys. We're thinking more about communities and place than we used to. A lot of it is about just showing people the way, explaining to them how their role now fits into that and, you know, not being negative about the way they have done the role in the past. That most people have been doing a very good job at delivering the services as they were needed at the time. So to the extent you need to motivate them to do something different, it's often just about showing them what's new now and how they can do it, and they will take to it with gusto. But I don't find that particularly frontline staff in the public service space need much motivation at all. They're really just off and running.
Yeah, it's amazing, I think, actually, that in transport, what I see and what I personally feel is that everyone feels very passionate and committed to the cause, right? Because you know that you're making a difference, both to people's lives and whether or not they actually catch public transport service delivery has an impact on everyone who lives in a city and region. So I wanted to talk a bit more about your career And, you know, what I think is incredible is that you've had an amazing number of different opportunities and roles that you've done. And as you said, you've spent a large part of that in the infrastructure industry and in various parts of that. But with the opportunities that you've had, you know, you've worked in public and private sector, in the not-for-profit space, you've studied on a number of different topics. And I wanted to understand from you, you know, how have you found yourself with those opportunities and made the decisions around the types of things that you might give a go? And how has that culminated in your ability to fulfill your current role?
Yeah, I'm not really someone who's ever planned too much when it came to my career. I know some people have these 5 and 10 year plans, but I haven't really done that along the way. I've typically gone for roles where I felt like what I was doing was worthwhile. That's usually a key driver, but also often attracted to a role by whoever it was that was recruiting me. You know, typically a pretty compelling leader is what I would say. And so sometimes I've taken a role a bit on faith. You know, if somebody has said to me, outlined their vision for what they wanted to do with the company or the organisation, even if the role for me wasn't particularly clear, but they just really had a vision and wanted me to be part of it, and I've gone with it. I've probably done some what people would regard as risky things. I moved to Malaysia never having been there. And in fact, the role that I had in Malaysia with an English company for 4 years, I applied for because I thought the job was in London, and I only found out after I'd got down into the interview process that it was actually in Malaysia. And I thought, what the heck? I like the people. And Malaysia sounded great, and I absolutely loved it. So I wouldn't say I've been reckless, but I have taken what some people would say are risks. But it's usually been because whatever the organisation's purpose was resonated with me, and because the people I met in the interview process, in particular, whoever I was going to work for most immediately, I could really relate to, and they really inspired me. And I don't feel like I've ever gone wrong making choices on that basis. There's often a time when you feel like it's time to move on. If you've been there, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years or whatever, the time has come to do something different. But I've never regretted moving into a role for those reasons.
Yeah, that's great insight and reflection. Thank you, Elizabeth. I think there's something for all of us to think about in that. And so I wanted to ask you as a last question. So we might have some listeners out there who are early on in their careers in public transport and the mobility space. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I usually give young people, but particularly young women, the same advice. And it really is to just say yes when you're asked a question, you know, if you're offered an opportunity. I think that you can spend too much time analysing pros and cons and everything, and that's a useful thing to do. But particularly for women and young women, they can get hung up thinking of all the reasons they can't do something, whereas they should just say yes. You know, if it's what they want to do and they think they can do it well, then they should just do it. Don't think too much about the detail in the PD of bits they haven't done before. Just say yes and take a bit of a risk and follow your heart is probably, that's what I would say. I do say that quite a lot.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth. That's such great advice. I feel the same actually about saying yes to every opportunity. And I think what's so exciting is that there's a lot of opportunities in public transport. So I've gone through all of my questions, but is there anything that you'd like to make a comment on before we finish off?
Oh, Michelle, probably the only thing I'd say, you know, is I feel genuinely privileged to be part of the public transport sector. It wasn't, if you'd asked me when I was, you know, in my early 20s, was that where I was going to end up? I wouldn't have said that, but I'm so thrilled to be part of it. And you would see the same, you know, it's a great community to be part of across the world. And we are really vital to keep cities and countries going, but it's also just the sense of public service that I think most people in the sector have, and that's regardless of whether they're public or private. They have this sense of service, which I think sort of binds us all. So I really love it, and I genuinely encourage people to join us and give it a crack. I've found it a very rewarding place to end up at a relatively late stage of my career, but I'm truly loving it.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I really like that sentiment that working in public transport is a privilege. And certainly being part of the UITP community, it's incredible how many people I've met from around the world who really do feel that. So I wanted to say thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been so great to hear what you're working on and the insights into some of the challenges you're tackling, but also for you to share some of your personal stories and advice and to hear your commitment to public transport.
Thanks, Michelle.
I also want to thank everyone who's listening to this episode. We've got plenty more fantastic women who move nations lined up for you. So hope you join us again soon.
Thank you to everyone for listening to this week's episode of Women Who Move Nations. This series is co-produced by Cassandra Kadelka and Lara Rudd, with copywriting by Sophia Dickinson. Please join us each week as we raise the voices of women in the public transport and mobility sector. I'm Michelle Batsis. Keep safe and keep our nations moving.